Sunset Notes. According to one school of thought, notes such as these are unnecessary at best and suspect at worst. The argument against is that stories which need explanation are probably not very good stories. I have some sympathy with the idea, which is one reason to put this little addendum at the end. Putting it here also avoids those tiresome cries of spoiler, which are most commonly uttered by spoiled people. The reason to include them is simply that many readers like them. They want to know what caused a story to be written, or what the author was thinking when he wrote it. This author doesn't necessarily know either of those things, but he can offer some random thoughts that may or may not be of interest. Willa. This probably isn't the best story in the book, but I love it very much because it ushered in a new period of creativity for me, as regards the short story at least. Most of the stories in Just After Sunset were written subsequent to Willa, and in fairly quick succession over a period of not quite 2 years. As to the story itself, one of the great things about fantasy is that it gives writers a chance to explore what might or might not happen after we shuffle off this mortal coil. There are two tales of that sort in Just After Sunset. The other is The New York Times at Special Bargain Rates. I was raised as a perfectly conventional Methodist, and although I rejected organized religion and most of its hard and fast assertions long ago, I hold to the main idea, which is that we survive death in some fashion or other. It's hard for me to believe that such complicated and occasionally wonderful beings are in the end simply wasted, tossed away like litter at the roadside. Probably I just don't want to believe it. What that survival might be like, though, I'll just have to wait and find out. My best guess is that we might be confused and not very willing to accept our new state. My best hope is that love survives even death. I'm a romantic, so fucking sue me. If so, it might be a bewildered love and a little bit sad. When love and sadness occur to my mind at the same time, I put on the country music, people like George Strait, BR549, Marty Stewart, and the Derailers. It's the latter who are playing in this story, of course, and I think they're going to have a very long engagement. The Gingerbread Girl. My wife and I live in Florida for part of the year now, near the Barrier Islands, just off the Gulf of Mexico. There are a lot of very large estates there, some old and gracious, some of the bloated nouveau sort. I was walking with a friend on one of these islands a couple of years ago. He gestured at a line of these McMansions as we walked and said, "Most of these places stand empty 6 or even 8 months of the year. Can you imagine that?" I could, and I thought it would make a wonderful story. It grew out of a very simple premise, a bad guy chasing a girl along an empty beach. But, I thought, she'd have to be running away from something else to start with. A gingerbread girl, in other words. Only, sooner or later, even the fastest runners have to stand and fight. Also, I like suspense stories that turn on crucial little details. This one had a lot of them. Harvey's Dream. I can only tell you one thing about this story, because it's the only thing I know, and probably the only thing that matters. It came to me in a dream. I wrote it in a single sitting, doing little more than transcribing the tale my subconscious had already told. There's another dream story in this book, but I know a little more about that one. Rest Stop. One night, about 6 years ago, I did a reading at a college in St. Petersburg. I stayed late and ended up driving home on the Florida Turnpike after midnight. I stopped at a rest area to tap a kidney on the way back. You'll know what it looked like if you've listened to this story, a cell block in a medium-security prison. Anyway, I paused outside the men's room because a man and a woman were in the ladies having a bitter argument. They sounded very tight and on the verge of getting physical. I wondered what in the world I'd do if that happened and thought, I'll have to summon my inner Richard Bachman because he's tougher than me. They emerged without coming to blows, although the lady in the case was crying, and I drove home without further incident. Later that week, I wrote this story. stationary bike. If you've ever ridden on one of those things, you know how bitterly boring they can be. And if you've ever tried to get yourself back into a daily exercise regimen, you'll know how difficult that can be. My motto, eating is easier, but yes, I do work out. This story came out of my hate-hate relationship, not just with stationary bikes, but with every treadmill I ever trudged and every stairmaster I ever climbed. The things they left behind. Like almost everyone else in America, I was deeply and fundamentally affected by 9/11. Like a great many writers of fiction, both literary and popular, I felt a reluctance to say anything about an event that has become as much an American touchstone as Pearl Harbor or the assassination of John Kennedy. But writing stories is what I do, and this story came to me about a month after the fall of the Twin Towers. I might still not have written it if I had not recalled a conversation I had with a Jewish editor over 25 years before. He was unhappy with me about a story called Apt Pupil. It was wrong for me to write about the concentration camps, he said, because I was not a Jew. I replied that made writing the story all the more important, because writing is an act of willed understanding. Like every other American who watched the New York skyline burning that morning, I wanted to understand both the event and the scars such an event must inevitably leave behind. This story was my effort to do so. Graduation afternoon. Long notes for such a short story. For years following an accident in 1999, I took an antidepressant drug called Doxepin, not because I was depressed, he said glumly, but because Doxepin was supposed to have a beneficial effect on chronic pain. It worked, but by November of 2006, when I went to London to promote my novel, Lisi Story, I felt the time had come to give the stuff up. I didn't consult the doctor who prescribed it, I just went cold turkey. The side effects of this sudden stoppage were interesting. For about a week, when I closed my eyes at night, I saw vivid panning shots, as in a movie, woods, fields, ridges, rivers, fences, railroad tracks, men swinging picks and shovels on a stretch of road construction, and then the whole thing would start over again until I fell asleep. There was never any story attached. They were simply these brilliantly detailed panning shots. I was sort of sorry when they went away. I also experienced a series of vivid post-Doxepin dreams. One of them, a vast mushroom cloud blossoming over New York, became the subject of this story. I wrote it even knowing that the image has been used in countless movies, not to mention the TV series Jericho, because the dream had a documentary matter-of-factness to it. I woke with my heart pounding, thinking this could happen, and sooner or later it almost certainly will happen. Like Harvey's dream, this story is more dictation than fiction. N. This is the newest story in the book, and published for the first time here. It was strongly influenced by Arthur Machen's The Great God Pan, a story that, like Bram Stoker's Dracula, surmounts its rather clumsy prose and works its way relentlessly into the reader's terror zone. How many sleepless nights has it caused? God knows, but a few of them were mine. I think Pan is as close as the horror genre comes to a great white whale, and that sooner or later, every writer who takes the form seriously must try to tackle its theme, that reality is thin, and the true reality beyond is a limitless abyss filled with monsters. My idea was to try and wed Machen's theme to the idea of obsessive-compulsive disorder, partly because I think everyone suffers OCD to one degree or another. Haven't we all turned around from at least one trip to make sure we turned off the oven or the stove burners? And partly because obsession and compulsion are almost always unindicted co-conspirators in the tale of horror. Can you think of a single successful scary tale that doesn't contain the idea of going back to what we hate and loathe? The best overt example of that might be The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Gilman. If you ever read it in college, you were probably taught that it's a feminist story. That is true, but it is also a story of a mind crumbling under the weight of its own obsessive thought. That element is also present in N. The Cat from Hell. If Just After Sunset has the equivalent of a hidden track on a music CD, I guess this would be it. And I have my longtime assistant, Marcia DiFilippo, to thank. When I told her I was going to do another collection, she asked me if I was finally going to include The Cat from Hell, a story from my men's magazine days. I responded that I surely must have tucked that story, which was actually filmed as part of Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, in 1990, into one of the previous four collections. Marcia provided tables of contents to show that I had not. So here it is, over 30 years after it was originally published in Cavalier. It came about in an amusing way. The fiction editor of Cavalier back then, a guy named Nye Wilden, sent me a close-up photograph of a hissing cat. What made it unusual, other than the cat's rage, was the way its face was split down the middle, the fur on one side white and glossy black on the other. Nye wanted to run a short story contest. He proposed that I write the first 500 words of a story about the cat. They would then ask readers to finish it, and the best completion would be published. I agreed, but got interested enough in the story to write the entire thing. I can't remember if my version was published in the same issue as the contest winner or later on, but it has since been anthologized a number of times. The New York Times at special bargain rates. In the summer of 2007, I went to Australia, leased a Harley Davidson, and drove it from Brisbane to Perth. Well, I stuck the bike in the back of a Toyota Land Cruiser for part of the Great Australian Desert, where roads like the Gun Barrel Highway are what I imagine the highways look like in hell. It was a good trip. I had a lot of adventures and ate a lot of dust. But getting over the jet lag after 21 hours in the air is a bitch. And I don't sleep on planes, just can't do it. If the stewardess shows up at my seat with those funky pajamas, I make the sign of the cross and tell her to go away. When I arrived in Oz, after the San Francisco to Brisbane leg, I pulled the blinds, crashed out, slept for 10 hours, and woke up bright-eyed and ready to go. The only problem was that it was 2 a.m. local time, nothing on TV, and I'd finished all my reading matter on the plane. Luckily, I had a notebook, and I wrote this story at my little hotel desk. By the time the sun came up, it was done, and I was able to sleep for another couple of hours. A story should entertain the writer, too. That's my opinion. We welcome yours. Mute. I read a story in my local newspaper about a high school secretary who embezzled over $65,000 in order to play the lottery. My first question was how her husband felt about that, and I wrote this story to find out. It reminds me of one of the poison bonbons I used to sample weekly on Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Ayana. The subject of the afterlife, as I've said earlier in these notes, has always been fertile soil for writers who are comfortable with the fantastic. God, in any of his supposed forms, is another subject for which tales of the fantastic were made. And when we ask questions about God, one near the top of every list is why some people live and some die, why some get well and some do not. I asked it myself in the wake of the injuries I suffered in 1999 as the result of an accident that could have easily killed me if my position had been different by only inches. On the other hand, if my position had been different by other inches, I might have escaped completely. If a person lives, we say, it's a miracle. If he or she dies, we say, it was God's will. There is no rational response to miracles, and no way to understand the will of God, who, if he is there at all, may have no more interest in us than I do in the microbes now living on my skin. But miracles do happen, it seems to me. Every breath is another one. Reality is thin, but not always dark. I didn't want to write about answers. I wanted to write about questions, and suggest that miracles may be a burden as well as a blessing. And maybe it's all bullshit. I like the story, though. A Very Tight Place. Everyone has used one of those roadside porta-potties from time to time, if only at a turnpike rest area in the summertime, when state highway departments have to put out extra bathrooms to cope with the increased flow of travelers. I'm smiling as I read this, thinking how marvelously excretory it sounds. Gosh, there's nothing like stepping into one of those dim little roomettes on a hot August afternoon, is there? Toasty warm, and the smell is divine. In truth, I have never used one without thinking of Poe's The Premature Burial and wondering what would happen to me if the shithouse fell over on its door, especially if no one was around to help me get out. Finally, I wrote this story for the same reason I have written so many other unpleasant tales, constant reader, to pass on what frightens me to you. And I cannot close without telling you what childish fun this tale was. I even grossed myself out. Well, a little. And with that, I bid you a fond farewell, at least for the time being. If the miracles keep happening, we will meet again. In the meantime, thank you for listening to my stories. I hope at least one of them keeps you awake for a while after the lights are out. Take care of yourself, and say, did you maybe leave the oven on? Or forget to turn off the gas under your patio barbecue? What about the lock on the back door? Did you remember to give it a twist? Things like that are so easy to forget, and someone could be slipping in right now. A lunatic, perhaps. One with a knife. So, OCD behavior or not? Better go check, don't you think?
Just After Sunset was written by Stephen King and read by the author, Jill Eikenberry, Holter Graham, George Guidel, Ron McLarty, Dennis O'Hare, Ben Shankman, Skip Suddeth, Mare Winningham, and Karen Ziemba. It was recorded at Simon & Schuster, Carnegie Studios, and CDM Studios in New York, Video Box Studios in Los Angeles, and Rocky Mountain Recorders in Denver, Colorado. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producers were Travis Tunn and Amory Klimchak. And the directors were Fred Sanders, Karen Perlman, and Elisa Shokoff. Just After Sunset was produced by Elisa Shokoff. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.